essentials why I'm going to share with you some of the conclusions that I've come to based on the work with the people over there. Incidentally, we have seven of them in Washington right now, thanks to Bob, from the Soviet Union were being trained to be Free Congress Foundation field people. The notion that I should have a field man in Sverdlovsk and the Sakhalin Islands and Kiev and in Moscow and Bucharest and Sofia and places like that is rather extraordinary if you think about it. The conclusions that I've come to, and I welcome a challenge of these by any of the experts here on the panel, but the conclusions I have come to are as follows. The first is that, yes, it is true that communism as a driving ideological force in the country is dead. Most of the communists don't believe in it, and there is no longer any utopian world vision which is being presented. This, however, does not mean that there are no communists in the sense of people who want power. And in fact, what you have going on there is not so much of an ideological struggle, in my opinion, but a power struggle with people who want to maintain power versus people who would like to be in power. It is true, however, that the force that comes with a vision is causing many of the people who maintain at least some alliance to communism to pull in their horns. It is interesting to note, as Mayor Popov told me, that privatization is occurring at such a fast rate in Moscow among the communists who are taking state property and putting it in their own name. So they will become millionaires, that if this continues at the current pace, by the end of the year, half of Moscow will be in so-called private hands. It is also true that the suicide rate among members of the Communist Party has increased by about 1,000%, which I think, for people who have no vision beyond this earth, is a clear index that many of them think that the current ball game is over. But the Soviet Union remains a very important military power, perhaps not on the ground so much as with their missiles. And as such, this remains a tremendous problem, a tremendous challenge. It would be fine if our friend, the defense minister of the Russians, Republic were to somehow take power in that he suggests that the Russian Republic would join NATO and put its missiles under the control of the NATO commanders. I rather doubt that this is going to happen. But nevertheless, it is a particular challenge, especially in a destabilized situation. Secondly, the death of communism has caused people in the Soviet Union to go in two very opposite directions, in my observation. On the one hand, some people are now becoming very spiritually oriented. There is a genuine religious revival, and many people are interested in religion, and many people are finding solace in the church for the first time. So the church is beginning to fill the vacuum, and in the church in the broad sense, I'm not talking about the Russian Orthodox Church as such, but the Christian faith and other faiths, even the Muslim religion and the Jewish religion, are playing a role in this general spiritual revival. On the other hand, many other people are moving in precisely the opposite direction. They're becoming extremely cynical because their whole notion of what the Soviet Union stood for as a nation is gone. And their belief somehow in the system, even though they knew that it really didn't work all that well, their belief has collapsed, and therefore they have become very cynical and almost unworkable human beings. And so this is a problem for any society, any structure that will take over in the future. Thirdly, it is simplistic to think just in terms of people when we think of the future of the Soviet Union. We Americans like to boil things down to simple formulas. So it is Gorbachev versus Yeltsin. And it is, in fact, much more than that. There are lots of forces at work in Irkutsk, in Siberia. We trained 300 people who were supposed to be communists. They were more radically pro-free market. They were more against the Soviet Empire. They were more for the things that we believe in than many of the non-communists that we met in Moscow, people who had never joined the party or people who had left the party with big ceremony, but who were not committed to the things that we generally stand for in this room. And so to look at things always in terms of a simple head-to-head contest between two different rival factions is oversimplification of a very complex problem. We ought to, in my opinion, therefore, concern ourselves not so much with personalities and which leader is in control, as we ought to be concerned with pushing certain institutions, furthering democratic capitalism, and backing whatever reforms, whatever groups are willing to move in the right direction, rather than getting bogged down in who is part of what faction, because it is not for nothing that this area of the country was once part of the Byzantine Empire. Their politics is Byzantine, and you can interview two people, both of whom claim the other are agents of some kind, and when you interview them, you find out they agree on exactly everything, and they all stand for the same things, but they're both deeply suspicious of the other, and part of that, of course, is the society in which they have been raised in, but part of it also has to do with ethnic and other national differences, and I don't think we can or should be obscured in our thinking by that sort of operation. I think that Bill Buckley is correct when he says that the United States probably can't do anything to overtly rescue these very bad situation over there. However, I do think that we should do nothing to assist the situation as we have been doing, that is, in support of Mr. Gorbachev. This government of ours has been Gorbachev's chief defender, and from all quarters and all the interviews that we have conducted with people of all varieties, this is clearly a mistake and one which, no matter how much you talk to the high officials of the Bush administration, including the president himself, we can't seem to shake them from. The people over there are, the people that we have to deal with are people who are highly intelligent and in many cases very well educated and better thinkers in the elementary sense than many of the people I have to deal with elsewhere in the world and including in this country. But they are people who have not taken any responsibility for anything for a long time, people who cannot seem to think through how to make decisions. And that is the greatest challenge in dealing with these people. It's not the ideological challenge. It's not trying to convince them that we're right or something like that. They know it. The problem is all of us were brought up in societies, or most of us, where we could make decisions and where this became part of our way of thinking and looking at things, and there we have a very different group of people, and I find that the greatest challenge because they don't see how you can solve problems when it is self-evident, and that is something that cannot be taught overnight. Finally, there is the question of stability, and the U.S. government and many so-called experts on the subject place a high degree of importance on the question of stability. And I am not unmindful of this point, given the fact that the Soviets are an important military power. But it seems to me that our goals and objectives ought to be peace and freedom and self-determination for those people, and particularly the notion that they can forge their own destiny, and that we shouldn't let the question of stability get in the way of our thinking in this regard, because if that were the case and applied to this country when our founding fathers were at work, we'd all be British citizens. Finally, I hear over and over again from all sorts of people that visit there that, well, you know, there is really nothing we can do. And of course, Bob Preble and I disagree with that, in the sense that the work that we've been privileged to conduct over there has yielded extraordinary results. And we think that if everybody in this room were to drop everything they were doing and go over there and work with these people, there still wouldn't be nearly enough people to do the job. So I disagree that there is nothing that we can do, maybe not on a government-to-government basis, but certainly on a person-to-person basis, and with the assistance that many of you that work in institutions can give. But I also would say this, that we ought to believe in our own stuff a little more. Our ideas do have power. We act as if they have none. We act as if there is no hope, when in fact, you know, God is still in control. And if nothing else, if someone feels that they can't make another contribution, we can always pray for those good people in that country. So with that, I will begin the panel. I'm going to introduce each of you one at a time, because that way, you see, it'll give me the opportunity to get up and sort of hint that maybe you should wind up your initial presentation. We want to try to make the initial presentations rather short, because there are lots of questions that people have in the audience, and we want to have the opportunity to give them as much time as possible to question this distinguished panel. The first member of the panel is the historian and educator Richard Pipes, who was born in Poland, came to the United States in 1940, became a citizen, has been on the faculty of Harvard from 1950 on in various capacities, has been a senior consultant at Stanford Research Institute. Probably his greatest contribution, at least from my point of view, other than the volumes and volumes that he has written on Russian policy and the whole notion of détente and so on, has been as chairman of the so-called B team, which did the revised intelligence estimates in 1980, and which really began that work began in 1976, and that work between 1976 and 1980 really began, I think, the great debate in this country about what our capabilities were, and we owe Richard Pipes a great debt of gratitude for that. He was a member of the Reagan transition team for the State Department in 1980, whereupon all of this advice was summarily ignored. But in any case, he has made many contributions to the understanding of our dealings with the Soviet Union, and so let's welcome Richard Pipes.